Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. My name is Matt Harrington. I am your host, and we are going to be talking all about ABA research. In this podcast, we break down one ABA research article per episode, taking out the key findings for you so that on your morning commute or on your way into work, you can become a better behavior analyst. Now, let's get to the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Behaviorist Book Club podcast. I am super excited to start off the month of July, as well as start off an entire new series with you. We're going to call this series the Essential Readings for Behavior Analysts, and it is going to be a collection of about 12 to 15 articles that I think are crucial readings for anybody who is a behavior analyst, whether you are somebody who has been certified for 5 years or 10 years, or just got certified last week. This was my personal reading list that I updated and developed as soon as I became a BCBA, and the very one I give to my supervisees to make sure that they're not only prepared to pass the exam, but actually be a good behavior analyst afterwards. So I am so excited to work through this list with you. In a broad overview, we're going to have some articles on ethics, some articles on how to act as a behavior analyst. There's going to be a section on behavior reduction, a section on skill acquisition, as well as a section on supervision and training. Now, we're not going to cover every single possible thing you need to learn as a behavior analyst. Many of these articles are going to be designed as jumping off points, right? Seminal articles that you need to start with so that you can go on and read more and more on your own, especially in the skill acquisition side. There are so many things we could talk about for skill acquisition. We're talking about some of these foundational articles in this series. But I hope that this gives you not only a reading list, but also all of the information you need to step into your own behavior analyst role and be a really damn good behavior analyst yourself. So the article that we're going to be talking about today is Moores and Colleagues 2024 Towards a Further Understanding of Assent. This was published in JABA, volume number 57. So why did I choose this article? I firmly believe that if we don't have assent at the focus and center of our care, it's going to be a crappy time for both us and our outcomes and the client that we're serving. Now, we're going to talk more about assent, trauma-informed care, shaping this whole kind of assent-based process throughout the entire series of readings that we go through, because you'll find that, hey, it's my essential readings and this is the way I practice ABA. But here, we're not going to talk about all of the questions that come after. I encourage you to hold on to your questions until we get more of the practical articles about how to do these interventions and how to incorporate assent, and instead spend some time thinking about this theoretically. Think about it conceptually and think about what kind of behavior analyst do you want to be and how you want to serve your clients moving forward. The important thing here is not that we answer every single how-to question about assent-based care. Do not misunderstand me. Assent-based care is incredibly complicated. It is very difficult to do. If you think assent-based care is simply, oh, we don't want to upset him, so we just let him do whatever he wants, that is not assent-based care. Assent-based care is also not, if he gets upset, he gets out of it, period, no questions asked. Assent-based care, at its core, is centering the learner's choice and letting them choose to do the next activity, to do the next thing, and to continue engaging in the current thing. Now, that doesn't mean that it's always going to be easy for the learner, and that doesn't mean that we're never going to push the learner. It means that ultimately the choice of whether to engage in an activity or not to is on the learner, not on us. And this makes total sense, right? Imagine you go into your therapist's office and you sit down in that chair, and then straps lock you in and you can't move. And then the therapist looks at you and says, so let's talk about your family trauma, right? That's just not how life works. We expect much more autonomy than that in our day-to-day life. And thus we should afford that same autonomy to the clients we're serving. Now, soapbox a little bit, went off on a rant. Let's bring it back to center and let's talk about this article, which essentially is serving as considerations and theoretical applications of assent-based care and what you can take away from it as a behavior analyst. This is a follow-up paper to, I believe it was a 2021 paper by Moores and colleagues, the one that for me really started the assent conversation. Now, there was other articles that were in the same
in the same time that also was talking about it. There was also articles way back when that talked about ascent. Ascent is not a new concept in behavior analysis by any means. But in my talking to other behavior analysts, this was Morris's original 2021 article really reignited the conversation. And then articles like Rogerman and colleagues Towards a Trauma-Informed Application of Behavior Analysis really stepped into the practical, which, spoiler alert, we're talking about that one next. Talking about ascent, we talk a lot about data. We talk a lot about outcomes. One thing that we sometimes don't talk about as much is social validity. It's something that we know is important and crucial to our field, but oftentimes social validity gets relegated to caregiver surveys or post-intervention. What ascent brings us back to is essentially social validity from the person experiencing the intervention and constant measurable social validity that can be tracked over and over again. As a legal term, what ascent is somebody who is not able to verbally give consent for whatever reason, giving assent and saying, yes, we can continue, yes, I will choose to do this, with their behaviors and their actions. This has become an extremely useful tool in behavior analysis because we're often working with learners who don't have the ability to give verbal consent for any reason. And to be clear, assent and consent is actually more of a legal term. It's used in court cases, it's used in law to assess lots of different things. The way we're using it here is essentially, are you choosing to go to the next thing? Are you choosing to actively engage in this current thing? Now, the point of this paper was to refine the definition and conceptualizations of assent, provide a 6 key considerations for embedding assent into practice, and then talk about future directions of research. This was a conceptual research paper. There was no experiment designed. It was essentially the expertise of these authors then applied into a paper to disseminate it for practitioners. What are these 6 key considerations of assent? Let's go through each of them and we'll talk about each one in turn. Is assent applicable and feasible? So, first thing to think about as a practitioner is, in your current setup, in your current environment, is this something possible? So, when your client, for example, so the first thing to think about is assent applicable and feasible? Now, this doesn't apply in most cases. This, once again, gets back to that legal definition of assent and the ability to also rely on verbal consent if you also need information about, is this person saying yes to the next series of activities? One thing you'll find is that tracking assent really well and doing it correctly takes time. It takes time away from other activities that you could be doing as a behavior analyst, as well as your behavior technician's time. And the reason I call that out is we can always track assent in small, easy ways, but we don't need to go into the highly complex tracking of assent if we can get verbal consent ongoing as well. And so if your learner is somebody where they have the ability to verbally consent to the different activities, assent might not be this whole aspect of your intervention. It may just be a small component. A good example of this is I was working with a teenager. He wanted to improve his social skills to make more friends at school. And we focused on improving his social skills and we practiced. And when he said he didn't want to do something, we didn't do it. And when he said that he wanted to do something, we went and did it. That was a situation where verbal consent was more than enough for me to feel comfortable as a practitioner that this mattered for him. We were working on something that was value aligned with his goals as a child. And it was something that he wanted to partake in. It was a journey he wanted to take. So I said, sure, let's do it. In that situation, we didn't need assent to be tracked as precisely because we had the verbal consent.
80 CEUs, $10 a month, 3 to 5 new CEUs being added every single month. Straightforward, simple. That's CEU Streamline. I created the Netflix of CEUs with all of not only my old content, but 3 to 5 new hours of CEUs being added every single month. Right now, we're at 85 videos and climbing more and more with over 400 behavior analysts getting all of the CEUs they could dream about for only $10 a month. So if you're interested, go ahead and go to behavioristbookclub.com and click the link that says Streamline Info or check the link below this episode. I know that you will love it and I guarantee you that you will get all the CEUs you need at finally an affordable price.
Now, number two is extremely crucial. Assess assent-related skills. So what they're talking about here is essentially the skill of making a choice and discriminating those choices. When you have two options in front of you, you're likely going to go with the option that results in more reinforcement for you, and in the past has resulted in more reinforcement. So A and B, you choose the one that has resulted in more reinforcement. But what if you don't have the ability to discriminate the difference between A and B? At that point, what you've now created is a random choice. It's 50-50. And selecting a random choice, flipping a coin, is not assent. It is a choice, but because the learner isn't aware of what could happen in either state, it's not assent because they don't know what's going on. The ability to make that discrimination comes down to the skills of the learner to identify critical features of those stimuli put in front and then associate them with past reinforcement history, as well as the ability, the actual stimuli, to be very different and very clear and very obviously linked to other situations. And the reason I separate them like that is because that's your solutions to this challenge. If your learner doesn't have the ability to discriminate, then you either need to teach the skill of choice making with discrimination training and then observational learning likely, or you need to make your stimuli much more obvious and visible. And the reality is you're probably going to do a combination of both. Next, we're going to design the assent procedure is number three. This, of course, uses that behavioral framework, exposes clients to options, tests their understanding, and arrange real and meaningful choices, including, of course, the ability to say no. This is something that for a learner who doesn't have any experience choice making is essentially the intervention to getting to choice making, right? So you have them experience a contingency, maybe choice A or work area A. They experience the contingency, the benefits, and the not so great benefits of that contingency, whatever it may be. And then you pull them out. You show them that, yes, this situation was associated with the stimuli. And then you have them experience another one. Now, you do this in a way so that they can clearly learn that discrimination, which then pushes them into choice making. Now, this is important because if they haven't experienced the options in front of them, then they can't really make an educated decision. A good example of this is if you asked me, do you like skydiving or would you rather go to brunch? I've went to brunch and I've never been skydiving. So I know the reinforcement associated with brunch, but I don't know the reinforcement associated with skydiving. For me to make an informed assent decision, I need to experience both of those situations. In most cases, getting our learner to experience another situation they haven't is not as complicated as skydiving. Usually it's just, all right, let's try it out and see if you like it. But the key is to, of course, associate trying it out with the correct stimuli so they can then make a discriminated choice. Next, we're going to ensure a fair choice. Now, this is one of the biggest hiccups that I see behavior analysts get into when it comes to assent-based care. The first time I was teaching assent-based care to a clinician, they said, that sounds great. I understand. I'll design my intervention. And their intervention was, if you're doing work at the table, you get iPad, you get unlimited access to food, and you get all the therapist attention. And if you choose, quote unquote, to not work at the table and sit on the ground, you're being ignored by the therapist. There's no food, or rather no free snacks, and there's no iPad. And I said, that's not assent, right? That's just coercion, right? You're stacking all the reinforcement in one place and you're not giving any to the learner who's engaging in the alternative behavior. This is a great example of why we need things like degrees of freedom designed in our behavior plans. Now, degrees of freedom is a term pulled from the nonlinear contingency analysis world. It's a fantastic concept. At a very basic understanding, I don't have time to get into it in the full explanation here. It is essentially the amount of options you have if all options are equal, right? So in degrees of freedom, it says whether I go to brunch or I go skydiving, they're the same equal value to me. So I can truly choose between one or the other. In that other example with the client, whether he sits at the table and works or whether he sits on the floor and chills, they still have the same access to reinforcement. Only when reinforcement is equal can we have true degrees of freedom, aka without coercion. Next, number five, we choose when to assess assent, and we do it frequently and often. When you think about informed consent, for example, like at the doctor's office, you go in for your procedure, the doctor tells you all about it, and then he hands you a form. You sign on the dotted line, and there's your consent for the whole procedure. At no point in the next hour, 2 hours, do they technically need you to sign another paper that says, it's been 30 minutes, I'm still thinking about it, but yes, I agree to do this. They get your signature once, and they're off to the races. That's different than assent. When it comes to assent, you have to get in and check over and over again. Now, this is even more important as you think about how long our sessions actually are. If you're in the clinic, you might have a kid for 5 hours a day, right? Assent at 9 a.m. right before they've had breakfast is very different than 2 p.m. when they're grouchy from not having a nap, right? So you have to measure assent throughout the entire time and keep an eye on that data in terms of timing, right? Are you seeing tons of assent withdrawal at 2 o'clock and they keep on complaining that they're hungry? Maybe we program a snack at 1:30, which helps them power through the last 45 minutes of session. And finally, number 6, there should be both informal assessment and assent adjacent behavior. So when we're tracking assent, what does that actually mean? What behaviors are we looking at? We're looking essentially at, are they moving towards and going with the next activity? Once you get more granular on a client-by-client basis, you can start to define what assent behavior actually is. Think of this as sitting down at the table and scooting their chair in, picking up the pencil and then starting to write, looking at you when you ask them to do a task or something like that. These are all individual examples of assent-forward behavior, but they change kid by kid. There are learners where if they're sitting and scooting their chair into the table, that doesn't mean they have assent. It just means in the past they've been coerced to do that, so now they do it as well. So make sure you define this individually and look not just at, oh, they're smiling, they must be assenting to care. Get more granular and look specifically at, if they do this, that means they're moving forwards and to intervention. If they're not doing, that means there isn't assent being provided. Okay, so those are the 6 key takeaways. What does that look like? Okay, so those were the 6 measures and considerations to have for assent in practice. What are the key takeaways? Assent is a lot more complicated than signing on a piece of paper. Assent is something that you have to individually define for each client, track at a consistent and reliable schedule that actually gives you insight, and then design your interventions and procedures in a way where assent is possible throughout. It doesn't work if you only have assent for the first 3 hours and then after lunch you're in forced choices for the rest. Assent has to be something that is provided throughout and within the entire intervention plan. It's not just about avoiding an ethical gotcha. It is about creating a space for the learner to completely feel safe and move towards the intervention you design over and over again so that success is made on a consistent basis. Remember, when we're moving towards an intervention, when your learner is choosing to work with you, that means that they're going to do better because they're not spending their time trying to get away from the intervention. So yes, assent-based care is more challenging, it is more complex, but at its core, it will create a better outcome for your learner because they are moving towards every single time and not trying to get away. That's what I got for you. I hope you enjoyed the essential readings number 1. As a reminder, you can get all of this stuff as well as the articles and things like that at my blog. There'll be a little outro to talk to you about that in a second, but I hope you enjoy this. I hope you follow along with me and I'll see you in the next one.
Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. I hope you learned something, and I hope you continue to learn something as you tune in Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays to the Behaviorist Book Club. If you liked this episode, consider leaving us a review, sharing it with a friend, and most importantly, using it in your clinical practice. There's no other reason why I do this than to make you a better behavior analyst and to make myself a better clinician. See you in the next one.